Good evening. You're listening once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. I was listening to our station here in the Round Valley just a few minutes ago out in the car, and I don't know what's going on in here. It sounded so much better than it did the day before, and that's good. Also, folks, I want to let you know that we received our secondary television transmitter today, and we tested it. It's not channel 16 like I told you it was. We're having a big problem getting these channels right. It's actually channel 14. So if you were checking channel 15 and 16 today, you missed it. We were testing. We were on the air. The picture is beautiful. The sound is great. I spent all afternoon building the antenna. It's a Yagi type for the secondary transmitter. We should be receiving our primary transmitter, which will transmit on channel 15. And it comes with its own antenna. It will be here probably tomorrow tomorrow is Wednesday. Probably be here either tomorrow or Thursday. And as soon as it gets here, we'll be testing on air with that transmitter. And as soon as we see that everything's operating okay, we'll mount the antenna. And the Round Valley television station will be on the air. And boy, have we got some things to show you. Boy, have we got some things to show you. Yes, we've got an awful lot to show you. So those of you living here in the Round Valley, you're just a few days away from your own local television station that you've never had ever before, along with this radio station, 101.1 FM, and my, Monday through Thursday night broadcast, the Hour of the Time. And those of you listening on shortwave, then you know that we're also in worldwide shortwave radio all around the world. I got a letter today from, was it today or yesterday, from Costa Rica, getting letters from all over the world. A lot of people listen to this broadcast. Lots of people listen to this broadcast, including all the scum-sucking, rat-stinking, puke-faced, pig-subversive socialists in this country who, by the way, are also masochists. They got to get their whipping listening to the Hour of the Time four nights a week. Try as they might, they cannot stay away. They just can't believe that anybody's got the guts to say what I've got the guts to say on the air here. I want you all to get paper and pen, get ready for some sounding revelations. We've got a special guest tonight. He is ex-chief of police, Daryl Graff, from Medina. And I believe it was North Dakota, but we're going to find out in a few moments. And he was present at the shootout with the feds, or at least he was there at that town, and he was the police chief when the feds had the shootout with Gordon Call. And boy, I'll tell you what, he was an innocent babe before that happened, and his eyes have been opened. He's been doing a lot of soul searching, and he wrote a book, and we're going to talk about his book. He sent it to me a couple of months ago, and I read it, and it's a good book. You should all read it. So don't go away. We'll be right back with ex-chief of police Daryl Graff. And if you're a so-called peace officer, or as you like to call yourselves today, law enforcement personnel, or if you're a chief of police, or if you think you know all the answers and you're supposed to be serving the citizens in your community as some kind of a law person, whether it be on the police force, on the sheriff's department, or on the highway patrol, or you know, just an officer of the court. I think you better listen to what Chief Graff has to say.
Tarzan wasn't the latest man. He just come along from my father under his arm like that. Quick as a cat in the jungle. Clark Kent, now there was a real gent. He would not be caught sitting around in no jungle scheme. Dumber than he doing nothing. Superman never made anybody, saving the world from Solomon Grundy. And sometimes I just tell the world we'll never see another man like him. Hey Bob, Sue had a straight job. Even though he could have smashed through any bank in the United States, he had the strength, but he would not. Both said his family were all dead. Planet crumbled, but Superman, he forced himself to carry on. Get Krypton and keep going. Superman never made any money. Saved the world from Solomon Grundy. And sometimes I despair the world will never see another man.
Never see another man like him. Not since they killed him, huh? Didn't they kill Superman? My hero, ladies and gentlemen, is a lone, solitary Chinese student scared to death, who stood out in Tiananmen Square in front of 17 the most deadly killing machines ever invented by the mind of man, 17 huge tanks. He stood there all alone and stopped them dead in their tracks. Can you imagine the courage that took? I want you all to welcome Daryl Graff, the ex-chief of police of Medina. Was it North Dakota?
Yes, that's correct.
In North Dakota. And he was chief of police when the feds came in, who had heard or had been following or somehow knew that Gordon Call and some of his friends were having a meeting and decided to set an ambush for it. Why don't you give us a little bit of your history? How did you become to be chief of police in Medina, North Dakota? And what led up to all of this, Daryl?
Okay, well, first of all, Steve Schnabel, the co-author of the book, and he was my colonel of the police department who was wounded, is also here and on the phone at the same time. So if there's any questions that come up with regard to the actual shootout itself, he was right in the middle of it, so we've got him on as well.
Oh, okay. Well, we won't be taking any calls.
Oh, okay.
We have two phone lines. One is plugged into WBCQ, which takes our broadcast worldwide, and you're on the other one.
Okay.
But welcome, Steve.
Thank you. I was raised in Medina, North Dakota, a little town of 500 people, about 70 miles east of Bismarck, our capital city, right along Interstate 94. And agriculture is the main thrust of our entire state. You know, even industry is largely agricultural related. For instance, tractor manufacturers and combine, you know, different farm equipment manufacturers. So without agriculture, we have some serious problems. And in the early 80s, I was police chief of the town of Medina. My goal was to eventually get into the fire marshal's office, but I was doing what I could in our local community. And there were some meetings with regard to farm foreclosures. There was some very serious economic conditions in the farmland then, as there is again now, and there were several farm foreclosures happening, auction sales and so on happening in our area.
Isn't that what it was when it all boiled down to everything? Isn't that what it was really all about?
Well, yes and no. The meetings at Medina, North Dakota at that time were farm foreclosure meetings, although some of the problems we see in government far and wide, it's all connected together.
Yeah, but isn't that what really set the whole thing off to begin with?
Well, yes, that's what set it off in our area, but the major news channels, NBC, CBS, and them folks, when they came to town, they were so interested in the tax movement. Gordon Call was a known tax protester, so what they did is really pumped up the tax evasion thing. And it really took away the light that America needed to see the farm.
I got to interrupt you right here. Because on my show, we keep things in perspective and right on target. Gordon Call was not a tax protester. If he nor anyone else in this country can find a law passed by Congress that requires any one of us to file and pay taxes, he was a law-abiding citizen. Number one.
Okay.
And, well, basically, that's down to the core of it. Gordon Call was standing up and saying, hey, there's no law that requires us to do this. And so to call him a tax protester is wrong.
Well, he told me he was a tax protester.
Well, it's still wrong.
Okay.
I think he was just parroting what he was being called.
That's very likely,
yeah.
Yes. Because he absolutely did not believe in the way this system has gone. He came back from World War II. And I believe it was 1945, and when he got back to North Dakota, things just didn't seem the same. There was government programs, welfare, farming programs, and all kinds of stuff that weren't here when he left, and he just didn't like what he saw when he come back. And the more he studied into it, and the more that time had gone on, he could see where this nation was headed, and he didn't like the path it was taking.
That's okay. Go ahead. I'm just trying to adjust the pot here, okay. And I got a little feedback.
He absolutely didn't like the path our country was taking. And quite frankly, many of the things that he said in 1982 and 3 that I heard him say personally have come to pass or are in the process of happening now. So the guy was definitely ahead of his time.
He was right on, yeah.
He was right on. That's right.
Okay, so you were the police chief, and Steve was your colonel?
That's right.
Okay.
He was my chief deputy.
Okay, so what you call the colonel in Medina is what we would call the like assistant chief of police here.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Well, the shootout was on February 13th, 1983, and 3 days prior to that, an all-points bulletin was issued, and this thing, we believe, was fake and trumped up from the word go to try to get Gordon called to surface.
Okay, what was the all-points bulletin?
The all-points bulletin was that they had a federal warrant for Gordon Call, and he was believed to be in a certain station wagon heading to disrupt the sheriff's sale in the town of Minot. And the information that was broadcast on that bulletin turns out to be false. There was a lot of false information in it. And then they went as far, the Marshal Service issued this, a sheriff's department is who got blamed for issuing this, but there was some Marshal Service involvement kind of behind the scenes. And it basically said, if you see this individual, do not try to apprehend, but call the U.S. Marshal Service. And all that is, that's like throwing a dog a bone, you know, when you can have some over-eager officer get an all-points bulletin handed to him like that, he's going to go try to round the guy up himself just so he can climb up one more rung on that ladder to success in law enforcement.
Pretty stupid, huh?
Oh, yeah. That's just what happens, you know. So we had a local deputy sheriff that lived in our community, and Schnabel and I had a meeting when this all-points bulletin came out that if Gordon calls in our area, he's not causing any trouble with the citizens of our area, he's not out robbing banks, he's not breaking any laws that we know of, we don't want anything to do with his paperwork problems with the United States government. So we had a pact, and 3 days later, this deputy sheriff decided to change his mind and forgot to tell us that he was going to change his mind. And he saw Gordon Call was in town, he called his boss, and his boss said, "You heard what Graf said. Leave this alone. There's nothing to, you know, it's not our problem." And the next thing that happened was this guy jumps command, calls in the Marshal Service himself, and the rest of it's history. Some shots rang out. People died. Gordon Call believed he was protecting his family.
Well, he was, wasn't he? Wasn't his son with him?
Yes, his son and his wife and a friend and a couple more people that had attended the meeting.
And so when he found himself surrounded by cars and men getting out pointing guns at him, and actually somebody fired, who fired first?
Well, there's speculation that it was either United States Marshal Kenneth Muir for the District of North Dakota or his son Yori Call. And it's a gray area. We're really not exactly sure who fired first. And I just heard one the other day from Jerry Spence. You know, he said there was a rabbit hole in a log, and he asked Tom Brokaw if you went over there, do you think a rabbit's vicious? And Brokaw said no. And he said, do you think that if the rabbit had a bunch of young ones in there and you stuck your hand in there, it wouldn't do anything? And that, you know, that's kind of what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
Call was very concerned about his family because he was put in prison for refusing to file taxes, actually, through the Western District of Texas back in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And while in prison, he had a heart attack. His friend was also sentenced to prison in Stafford, Arizona, and his friend had a heart attack and died. Both were sentenced for tax violations. Neither with a history of heart disease. Both had heart attacks. Gordon pulled through. The other guy died.
Mm-hmm.
So Gordon figured the government was out to kill him, and he was never going to return to jail because of that.
What was the warrant that they said was issued for him?
The warrant was for failure to, a probation violation. He failed to sign some forms and send them in monthly. And this is a fiasco, too. We have a federal probation officer in Fargo named John Noah. John Noah would go out and visit with Gordon, and they became friends. He would go in and have lunch with Calls, and it was just like a real win-win situation. Well, for some reason, the District of North Dakota was divided with regard to parole and probation, federal parole and probation, and a new parole agent out of Bismarck got to handle Gordon's case, and some U.S. Marshals were pumping up this new probation officer about how dangerous Gordon was and that he's wacko, and they just really laid the groundwork and scared this guy half to death. So he goes to the farm, not very willing. Gordon refuses to cooperate with him, doesn't sign his form, so this guy turns Gordon into the Western District of Texas federal court for failing to comply with the probation violation. And the judge issues a withdrawal of the probation and issues a warrant.
All on a conviction for violating a law that doesn't exist to begin with.
Well, and for all this over at best a misdemeanor. You know, this was no felony. This guy wasn't out robbing banks or doing anything like that.
No.
It was a paperwork problem.
Mm-hmm. But originally, he was arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced and sent to prison for failing to file and pay the income tax.
Yes, Title 26, I think. And what Gordon told me specifically, he told me this story himself, was that he had indicated when he got to court that he was going to use the Constitution and the Bible to defend himself.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge let him know that I am the God of this courtroom.
Yeah, don't mention the Constitution and
yep,
forget about the Bible.
Constitution.
Yeah.
So his defense pretty much got washed away right there. And apparently there's no other place to take a case like that.
Well, there is. Our founding fathers knew where to take it. They took it to the canon.
Well.
And then that's where it's going to go ultimately here. There is no law in Title 26 or anywhere else that requires any citizen of any of the states to file and pay the income tax. In the United States Code, under the organizational structure of the Department of the Treasury, there is no such organization listed as the Internal Revenue Service. Therefore, it is not an agency of the United States government or the Department of the Treasury, like they claim. Neither is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. But that's neither here nor there. Let's go back and see what led up to this shootout. You say that the sheriff notified the marshals. How did the marshals know where Gordon Call was at?
They kept in close contact with the sheriff that called him. And,
how did he know? I understand this was not an advertised meeting, was it?
Oh, yes, it was. It was a meeting on farm foreclosures, and it was open to the public.
Oh, I see.
But this deputy sheriff, he apparently had either a thorn in his side or wanted to climb the rungs on the ladder to success or whatever the case was. We're not sure. But he knew that to leave things well enough alone would have been what we all agreed to. But it's like he had to get something stirred up. Well, he stirred something up all right. He kept in close contact with the Marshal Service. They sent two deputy marshals from Bismarck, about 70 miles away, to come in to Medina, and the U.S. Marshal and one of his deputies out of Fargo, which is 120 miles away, came in, and they attempted to set up a roadblock right in our community. Now, this is something we didn't learn in the North Dakota Academy. When you're going to, you know, try to tackle what they believe to be a violent, dangerous offender.
Yeah, you don't do it in the middle of town.
That's right.
With a whole bunch of innocent bystanders.
That's right. Within a block of a trailer court where small, you know, young families and small children live.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pointed out to me that, hey, these guys are setting up a roadblock at the trailer court, so, or at the railroad tracks right next to the trailer court. So I got on my radio and requested or demanded, however you want to look at it, that they leave our community. So they set up a roadblock outside of town and Call and his friends.
Now, wait a minute. Let's back up a little. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. You were not involved in this, were you?
No.
And why was that?
Because what was going on wasn't right. It just wasn't right.
Did you tell him that?
Yes. Had this been, if Gordon Call would have been a bank robber or a child molester, I'd have been right out there with him.
Mm-hmm.
But in these conditions, where this was a paperwork problem, and to position anyone in a place where bloodshed could be the end result, I didn't want anything to do with it. Because basically what happens is the federal people come to town, stir the hornet's nest. 2 days later, they're back in their federal building with their nice suits on, and we're out there with our dirty dungarees cleaning up.
Uh-huh.
And that lives forever, you know. They'll blame the local guy in a New York second. So
okay, let's go over to Steve then. Since you weren't involved in it at all, then let's go to Steve, because Steve was. How did you get involved in this, Steve?
Well, prior to the marshals.
Oh, and let me ask you first. If your chief of police thought it was wrong and he wasn't going to be involved in it, why were you?
Prior to the marshals, both parties getting to town, as soon as we found out that they were coming to town, we got on the phone and called certain members of the rescue squad and ambulance squad to meet us down at the fire hall. And once we got down there, we were trying to get things organized, make people aware of what was going on, what might happen. And it was either one of the marshals or the deputy was calling Daryl's unit number on the radio. Well, Daryl has had I don't know how many years of experience in the fire service ambulance squad. He was an EMT. He was much better at organizing that kind of stuff than I was. And when the marshals were calling, I thought they wanted directions on how to get to where the deputy sheriff was at watching the clinic. So I told Daryl, I'll go, you stay here, I'll go give him directions to the clinic. There's no sense in you doing that when your skills are needed here.
So
I thought I was just going to give these guys directions. I had no intentions of getting involved in this at all. And then when I met them, they handed me a shotgun and asked me to help them set up a roadblock.
And what did you say to that?
Well, I said, okay, I guess I will.
Big mistake, huh?
Big mistake. I was a rookie in every sense of the word, and I had never worked with U.S. Marshals before. The only thing I knew about them was what I saw on TV. You know, the guys know what they're doing, go out, save the day, and that's what I thought I was dealing with here, but I learned a good lesson that day.
Did the thought of maybe a little action in an otherwise boring law enforcement career pique your interest that day?
Yeah, it did.
Well, you're an honest man. Good for you. Okay, so what happened? Daryl wasn't there, so we'll go along with you until after this is over, and then we'll get back to Daryl and find out, you know, what all the consequences of this was. But what happened? Where did you go, and what did you do, and what did you see?
Well, prior, I think this kind of important. Prior to the marshals even getting to town, Deputy Marshal Cheshire, who was coming from Bismarck, called state radio and requested that some marked units stand by from surrounding counties just in case they needed them. Well, when that kind of call goes out, it's you don't stand by in your marked unit. You start heading towards that location, and Medina is a remote location. It takes a good 30 minutes for anybody to even get there, and that was a good call, and U.S. Marshal Muir got on the radio right after that and said, cancel that. It's not going any further than this. And this was, we didn't know about this. When we got out there, I met the marshals. Daryl saw they were going to set a roadblock up there and moved us out of town. We went about, well, it was about 0.8 miles out of town. And we were up there waiting for them to come out of town. There's a hill coming right out of town. As soon as they peaked the hill, they saw us down the road, and they turned into an approach.
By they, who do you mean by they? Who is they that saw you?
Gordon Call.
Okay.
Gordon Call and David Brewer were in one car, and Yori Call, Scott Fall, Joan Call, and Vernon Wagner were in another vehicle. And Gordon was in the lead, and he saw us up on the hill, and he turned in to an approach by a farmstead just outside of town. And as soon as they turned in, they were going to turn around and go the other way, and the other marshals were behind him and blocked him off. And at that point, everybody got out of their cars and had their rifles pointed at each other. And we started heading down the hill towards the scene, and we were probably 150 yards away or so, and Muir stopped his car. And Scott Fall started heading towards there was a shelter belt of trees by the trailer home, which was about 30 yards off of the highway, 30 to 40 yards. And he started heading towards those trees, so Deputy Wigglesworth headed off towards that direction to try and head him off. And as we were sitting there, Wigglesworth was gone, and we were still sitting there. And meanwhile, these guys down at the scene, the marshals, Cheshire and Hobson, are hollering at us. Get down here, you guys. We're staring down the barrels of these guns. Move in a little closer. Just, you know, getting pretty nervous. And so I got out of my car and went around and told Muir they wanted us to get down there. And it turns out he was on the radio calling state radio for backup. Now that he saw what kind of situation he was in, that this wasn't going to be U.S. Marshals drop your gun and come with us, and he's going to do it. Gordon had no intentions of going with them that day at all. And once he figured that out, then he took the time to call the backup. Meanwhile, they could have probably just about been there by that time. And
after knowing how he was treated the last time and wasn't allowed to present a defense in court, and the Constitution wasn't even allowed to be mentioned in the court, do you blame him?
Well, no. And in Gordon's mind, if he ever went back to prison, he was a dead man.
Yeah.
And he just wasn't going to let that happen if he had anything to say about it.
Sure.
We started going back down towards the scene, and lo and behold, we stopped again. And Muir was on the radio again, calling state radio, trying to see if they got any backup for us. And while we were sitting there, Hobson he's one of the marshals. He was standing in the ditch across the highway from the other cars, waving at me to come up there. And I'm thinking he wants something solid to get behind. We finally moved up there, got in position, and I thought Hobson was going to hop behind my car, and instead, he runs across the highway up to the station wagon and starts slamming the butt of his shotgun on the top of the station wagon. And I just, you know, right there, I even said it out loud. I said, oh, you know what, here we go, because I knew something was going to happen after that.
And why would he do something like that?
I have no idea. I really don't know. They didn't teach us anything like that in the academy.
Well, as far as I know, they don't do it in any academy, but I have seen so-called police officers go off like that all over the country all the time. I mean, this is not some isolated thing that they just do once in a while. This is pretty normal behavior.
Well, and it might be the old theory of if I act crazier than them, maybe they'll, you know, take a step back and look.
You act that crazy around me and you've got a gun in your hand, you're going to get shot.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what happened. A few seconds after that, the first shot rang out, and after that it was 15 to 20 seconds of gunfire, and during that time, when I got hit, bullet ricocheted under the car, hit me in the leg, and after that, I crawled down the ditch and faced the highway, and the shooting stopped, it was silent. After a few seconds, I heard some voices up on the highway. Later, I found out it was Joan Call. She was saying something like, this wasn't supposed to happen. This wasn't supposed to happen to our son. She was pretty upset,
yeah.
And I happened to look to the front of my car. I was more worried about Scott Fall because I don't know where he went. Last time I saw him, he was heading to the trees, and I never saw him after that. And that's why I got shot in the leg, because I was going to the back of my car to see if he was coming around behind me. And after the shooting stopped and I was in the ditch, I happened to look at to the front of my car, and there was a man standing in front of my car. One pull of the trigger, and he would have been dead. But I didn't know who he was. There was one marshal I had never seen out at the scene, Robert Cheshire. Didn't know what he was wearing, what he looked like. I had never seen any of these people before that day except for Deputy Sheriff Brad Capp. And I saw him running towards town after the shooting had stopped. So I knew it wasn't him. And I didn't know who it was. And as soon as he turned around and saw me, raised his rifle up, I put my shotgun up and took a chance and just said, "Don't shoot, I'm done." And did a lot of praying in a short time. And it must have paid off because I'm still alive today and grateful for it.
Now, who was it?
The man in front of the car turned out to be Gordon Call.
Well, he didn't set out that day to kill anybody, did he?
No, he didn't.
So, you know, he wouldn't have any reason to shoot you unless you acted like you were going to shoot him, would he?
Well, no. My main concern was if anybody looked like a federal agent out there, I did. And Gordon didn't have really any problems with the local agencies. It was the federal government he had his problem with. And here I am with camouflage fatigues and a Army flak vest on and looking like one of these guys hopping out of a helicopter.
Yeah, you didn't know it at the time, but you had a big problem with the federal government too, didn't you? Didn't this whole thing pretty much ruin your life?
Oh, yes. Yes, it did. Shortly after this, 3 days after this, the mayor called, or I'm sorry, 15 days after this, the mayor called a special meeting and ended up firing us. The whole department, not just me and Daryl, the whole department, there was four of us on the department. We all got the can, and it's never been the same ever since.
How did that happen, Daryl? Why did it happen?
Well, the mayor is related to most of the people in town, so that's why he got elected. Incidentally, that was his last term of mayor. Life got a little tougher for him after he pulled this crap, but the mayor was led down a path by people, and we're not really sure if he thought we should have helped kill Gordon Call, or if he thought we should have done more to protect Gordon Call, or if he was just very upset because the national spotlight was on this little town of 500 people. But he found scapegoats, the feds found scapegoats, And quite frankly, the call people thought we were spies back then, because I specifically had attended from some farm foreclosure meetings. My family was involved in a Amoco oil company for farm fuel deliveries. So I had an interest in, hey, what's going on with these farms and what's happening to our main street? I don't believe they knew I was police chief, and all of a sudden I show up out there, and it's like, oh boy, they're going to think I'm some kind of a spy, and I wasn't then, and I will never be a spy, but I could, looking at it through their eyes, I would have looked very suspicious. On the other hand, the marshals kept getting the word that I kept call off that they were setting up a roadblock for them, so the FBI and the U.S. attorney treated me just fine, but the marshal service, they would have sooner shot me than look at me, and they made that very clear. So we tried to do, our little department tried to do what was good and right and honest, and we got the raw end of the stick.
I thought all these, I could answer this question myself, but every time I hear these things, it just drives me wild. These are United States Marshals. They're supposed to uphold the law. They're sworn to protect and defend the Constitution, and they're looking for revenge, and of course, we know that they are, because when they ultimately caught up with Gordon Call, they just flat-out murdered him.
That's basically what happened, yes, an assassination.
Along with a couple of other people who were supposed to be on their side.
Yes. Now, we can go one step further. In the back of our book, we have an oath of office from a U.S. Marshal as compared to an oath of office from typical law enforcement or U.S. attorney or anyone else, and it's very clear. The U.S. Marshal Service doesn't have to do the things that the rest of us have to do with regard to their oath of office. The oath of office talks about, I will support and defend the Constitution of the U.S. against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and it goes on and on, where their oath of office says, I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute all lawful precepts directed to the United States Marshals for the blank district of blank under the authority of the United States. And it talks about make true returns, take only lawful fees, and it doesn't say anything about the Constitution in their oath.
Yeah.
So you got to wonder when this, if this has changed, and if it changed, why it changed. What's going on?
Well, it has changed, and we know why it changed, but that's not the subject of this broadcast. The United States Marshals are actually part of an organization called Interpol, which is an international police force. And therefore, under several agreements and resolutions and treaties with the United Nations, they are also under that body. So therefore, they can't have allegiance to a constitution if they supposedly have higher allegiances. You do understand that?
That would do it.
So, what did you guys learn from all of this?
That things in America are not getting any better, they're getting worse. And, you know, for a long time, we kept quiet, didn't make any waves. Fear had something to do with it. Afraid of certain people in various positions on both sides of the fence. But as time went on, and all of a sudden Ruby Ridge happened, and then Waco happened, it was like, wait a minute here. There's some things going on here that kind of reflect back to the early 80s. And it's almost like a signature of some of these people to burn a place down after they're done with their attack.
Yeah, that is not just Waco. And they were going to drop a fuel bladder full of fuel on Randy Weaver's cabin at Ruby Ridge. And some reporters walked onto the to this little landing clearing where they were fastening the fuel bladder to the bottom of the helicopter. And so they were discovered, and they didn't do that. But they burned the MOVE group, they burned the Symbionese Liberation Army, they burned the Branch Davidians, and I mean, we can go on and on and on. They burned those guys, I forget his name, but he was supposedly a member of what was called the Order up in Washington State.
Yes.
And yes.
It's become a trademark of some of these agencies. And it gets back to the Gordon Call case. When Gordon left North Dakota, he went to Arkansas, and he had some friends with safe houses down there, and he got shuffled from one house to another. Meanwhile, the feds are really upset about this. First time for a long, long time, more than one U.S. Marshal got killed at one incident, and the person that done the killing is now gone, and that was really tough for them to swallow. So they pulled every rabbit out of every hat they could and come up with a $25,000 reward.
Of course, none of it was their fault.
Oh, no.
None of it was their fault. They didn't do anything wrong. And then, of course,
And I'll tell you, Medina Police Department was, most of the marshals, like I said, they could have just as well shot me as look at me. They just had no use for me. And I tried to do what was good and right and honest, and that's the pay that I got, plus being fired. So at any rate, Gordon winds up in Arkansas, and he's holed up in this house. Actually, he's watching TV, according to the people that were convicted of harboring him. He's watching TV. They just had supper. He's watching that his son and his friend just got convicted in North Dakota. They're going to be sentenced for life sentences, two life sentences. And Gordon's thinking maybe he should turn himself in because then he could get his son and his friend out. He thought that might be a little ploy. Meanwhile, there's a mob of law enforcement outside the house where he was staying. And the stuff that happens after that, the official government reports that the newspaper had and so on, the physical evidence does not match what happened. And it's kind of like that stuff's being rejuvenated with the Waco thing. I believe, and I think Schnabel would concur, that if there's ever been a grand jury called in the United States, ever in the history of the United States, it needs to be in Arkansas about this deal, because it was one of the first ones on this long road to where the American citizens have been, assassinated assassinated even the people they didn't want to really get,
mm-hmm.
Scare tactics and the whole works. And had we known then what we know now, we probably would have become vocal right away with this thing, and it wouldn't have taken us 16 years to get a book out. But the stuff that went on in Arkansas, there is physical evidence that completely is 180 degrees away from what the newspaper reports were.
Now, I want to remind our listening audience that we're just not talking to somebody that's theorizing. You were the chief of police in Medina, North Dakota.
Yes.
And Steve was your second in command, so to speak.
That's right.
And you were trained in law enforcement, and you were in doing this job for some time.
Well, that's right, yes. I had about 7 years in law enforcement.
Okay.
And,
so you're not some yahoo that's just coming along to theorize about all this stuff. You were a part of it.
Oh, yes, very much a part of it.
And because you were a part of it and affected your life so much, you studied all of this stuff.
Every bit that I could.
And you have no reason to fabricate anything?
No reason whatsoever.
Okay. Tell us what you discovered.
Well, an investigation was done by a bunch of retired officers, including Jack McLam. You might know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And the physical evidence that has surfaced on the Gordon Call case in Arkansas, although I wasn't there and Schnabel wasn't there, it's astonishing how one person can shoot another in the back of the head while he's being shot with his arm raised in the air from the side. It is physically impossible for that to happen. Physical evidence does not lie, but some agents do. And what's unfortunate is there are some good people in the Justice Department. There are good people that do uphold the Constitution.
Where?
But, well, they're retiring.
And how would they know they're upholding the Constitution? I've never met one yet that's ever read it. Not one. And we had a conversation earlier today. All the years that you were in law enforcement, I'm not saying this to embarrass you. I'm just saying this to drive a point home for all those people in law enforcement who may be listening. All those years that you were under oath to protect and defend the Constitution, you'd never read it either.
You're right. I'm first to admit that. And as I said today earlier, every year we had to requalify with our handgun. Well, before you requalify, you got to sit down and read that thing and annually, just so it doesn't get too foggy in the mind. You know, it needs to stay sharp and clear in there.
Sure.
I've read it since, but back then, no, I'd never, high school days I read it, but, once I filed that oath of office, it was like, I'll sign this. And you're right, there's a lot of, most of them, probably 99% have never really taken a good look.
No, and if you had read it and had understood it and understood the limitations of the powers of the federal government, you wouldn't even have let them in your town.
Well, that's what's starting to go on in other counties in the United States now. I understand there's a sheriff in Wyoming that won't let the feds into his
County.
Into his county, unless it has something to do with something he agrees with, apparently.
Yeah.
But it's an uphill battle out there. And the politics, you know, the petty politics in these departments, and especially if you get somebody that stands tall and say, this isn't right, they cross that thin blue line, and it's tough. We found out, we tried to do what was good and right and honest and got fired, and it hit Associated Press that I was police chief, and I'd gotten fired 2 weeks later. So people in various parts of the United States called me, hey, will you see in the newspaper in Seattle, for instance, that you got fired? Now, it's pretty tough for me to go find another job.
Mm-hmm.
And that was orchestrated. That wasn't just an accident that this stuff came to light like it did. That was orchestrated.
Why do you think that the press was so hard? I mean, you guys were just incidental to this stuff. You really didn't have anything to do with it.
The press was very hard on me because of what they were being fed. And what they were being fed was I was, from one camp, they were told I was an undercover agent for the federal marshals. From another camp, they thought I was a call supporter and had set up the marshal service by calling them into our community so there would be a firefight.
But you're not the ones who called them in.
Absolutely not.
It was the sheriff.
But the people that did call them in, the sheriff and his man, the deputy sheriff that actually called them in, and the sheriff of our county.
And last time you saw him, he was running away.
You bet. And he's the kind of guy that don't back down from nothing, so he says, but all of a sudden he's running away from this incident.
Well, you know, I know a lot of guys who won't back down for nothing until something happens, and then you don't see them anywhere.
That's basically the situation here. And our county sheriff, I'm still a little upset because he should have stood forward and said, it was our man, it wasn't them. But silence was yellow.
Chicken pluckers.
Yeah. Sometimes silence is golden, sometimes silence is yellow. And in this case, silence was yellow.
Didn't they, in the process of murdering Gordon Call, also murder a sheriff or sheriff's deputy?
While in Arkansas, that situation, I believe Gordon Call was assassinated while he was watching TV, trying to, you know, seeing his son get sentenced and so on. Somebody come up, put a bullet in the back of his head, and the local sheriff who was in the room said, that's not Gordon Call, that's another man that was very similar in stature and appearance to Gordon Call. And all of a sudden, that sheriff takes a bullet, and he's laying on the floor. And then this Arkansas State Police investigator takes his shotgun with number 4 buckshot, goes around the outside of the house, blindly sticks the barrel in the window, and empties his shotgun into the, some of the pellets hit the sheriff's bulletproof vest and so on. The sheriff, the U.S. Marshal that was in the house, is now out by a tree rolling around and throwing up. He says that the sheriff told me he shot and killed Gordon Call, and then Gordon Call shot the sheriff. Well, again, this is coming from the deputy U.S. Marshal.
He was so sick of what happened that he's out throwing up all over the place.
That's right. That's right. Now, that should paint a little picture of what's going on here. You know, if we went through a tough ordeal, but we weren't throwing up.
Mm-hmm.
But had I gone up and put a bullet in the back of somebody's head, I'd have probably been laying on the ground throwing up, too. And you can read between the lines all you want, but I don't think we have to spell that out much more clear. Incidentally, the guy was given the Heroes Award for the Marshal Service for that year and $1,000 incentive or check.
So, by the way, folks, I've studied this for years, and I'm convinced that they murdered the sheriff and several other people also, not just Gordon Call and the sheriff, but, you know, they've been doing this for years. And I struggle with whether or not to have this gentleman, Daryl Graff, on the broadcast tonight, because you know my policy. And I don't want to make these guys sound or look like they did the right thing, because in my estimation, they should have arrested the federal agents. But they didn't, and they didn't understand what was going on. But what redeems them in my eyes, and to tell you quite frankly, if Daryl Graff hadn't admitted to me on the telephone that he had not read the Constitution and that it was wrong, and he now knows better, they wouldn't be on here tonight. I didn't know Steve was going to be here, but I'm glad he is now, because we got the firsthand account of what was going on. And I don't mean to add to your miseries or your problems because of all of the things that's happened to you guys since then, but I just don't have any sympathy for people who don't understand what this country is all about and are helping to bring it down. And in that instance, you guys were a part of helping to bring it down. You didn't know that at the time.
That's right. We didn't know that at the time.
But you know it now.
Oh, yes. We know how much loyalty there is. Zero.
We know it now, and if we didn't know it now, we wouldn't have spent over 2 years writing this book and researching it to get the true story out there of what really happened.
What's the name of your book?
It's called It's All About Power.
And I've read it, folks, and it's a good book. And as far as I can tell from all of the research that I've done into what really happened to Gordon Call and his family, they're telling the truth as close as it can possibly be told. Unfortunately, or fortunately, as it may be, they were involved in all of this, which makes it imperative that you do read their book, because the only people who know what happened were the people who were there, the people who were part of it, the people who know firsthand. The rest of us are getting all their stories and trying to piece it together as best we can, and trying to look at the physical evidence and court records and all of these things, and all of those things are not always available to us, nor can we always tell who's telling the truth and who's not. So testimony from people like this, I consider to be extremely important. We have about, about 5 more minutes. Well, we have, about 5 more minutes left in the broadcast.
Okay.
Daryl, why don't you and Steve go ahead and talk about what you think may be important for the listening audience to hear that we haven't discussed yet.
Well, the first thing that probably needs to be done is the local people need to visit with their local law enforcement people and let them know, in case they were blindsided like we were, they need to know what's happening in this country. And they need to stand up to the politics. I'll use this as an example. You know, there's violent gang members on the street corner with sharp knives and loaded handguns ready to do all kinds of bad things to innocent people. But some of the policemen will sit outside the local liquor store waiting for somebody to leave that's probably going to blow a 1-2. Now, I'm not advocating driving down the wrong side of the road by any means, but it's like a river. They take the path of least resistance sometimes. And to go out and corral somebody up that's one of these anti-government type people, call them a patriot, whatever the police choose to call people, survivalist patriots, whatever. They need to be spending more time getting these violent gang people that are killing innocent and robbing banks off the street than they do these people that are out trying to protect their rights. And they need to take a close look at the Constitution, and they need to take a close look at the rights of other people. If in our county somebody wanted to go 4 miles out of town and start a church and call it Mount Carmel, that's their business. As long as they're not robbing banks to fund their church, they can do anything they want. But apparently, someplace along the line, like our book says, it's all about power. Somebody gets on a power trip and they're going to show these people and them people, where the bear is in the buck brush and so on. Mm-hmm. And it's time for the people of the United States to wake up and advise their local law enforcement that, look, you're here to protect us, not to conspire against us with a bunch of people who have an agenda that doesn't match the Constitution of the United States.
Very good. I would like to, if I could, spend a few days with you, sort of rearrange your vocabulary. For instance, patriots are not anti-government. Patriotism in this country is pro-government.
Yes.
But most people don't know what the government is. And when we oppose what they believe to be government, which is not government at all, but despotism, and support true government, which is the Constitution for the United States of America, we are called anti-government. How can people who support the only true law, the supreme law, and that which outlines government and are ready to die for it with their life, be anti-government? And for instance, for most of my life, I spent in the service to my country. I was both in the Air Force and the United States Navy, and had only 5 years left until I could have retired very comfortably on the dollars paid in to government by all of the sheeple of this country. But I found out what was going on and decided that I couldn't be a part of it, and so I left. And I've been supporting government ever since. But yet, you know, you've still got an awful lot of that old preconceptions in you that comes with being a part of law enforcement.
Well, no, I'm not saying that that's how I feel. I'm saying that's what they call them. Law enforcement refers to people like Gordon Call as patriots or survivalists. That's not how I refer to them.
Well,
that's how law enforcement in general refers to them.
Patriot's fine. Anti-government is not. But patriot's fine. There's nothing wrong with being a patriot. The founding fathers were patriots. Everybody who ever served this country were patriots. Everyone who fought and died for liberty, for freedom, for the Constitution, for this country were patriots. How did it come to be a dirty word today? Anybody know? I don't know.
I think because people started forgetting about what this country was founded on, and when people, good people like you and others, start spreading the word and getting it out there what this country is all about, you're, in their mind, stirring up trouble.
And, oh, yes.
And therefore, patriot is a dirty word in their mind now.
William Jefferson Clinton, in a White House memo, named me the most dangerous radio host in America.
That's honorable.
It's the greatest honor that's ever been paid to me.
Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you both for being a special guest on the Hour of the Time. If you think we left anything out and you'd like to come back, give me a call and we'll do it.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, right now, tell everybody how they can get your book.
We've got an 800 number they can call, 1-800-495-7059. That's 1-800-495-7059. We've also got a website, www.mpdpower.com. That's MPD, like in Medina Police Department, .com.
Okay, I'll repeat that tomorrow night for everybody and remind them that they can get a copy. How much is the book?
$19.95
is worth every penny, folks. Well, thanks a lot, Daryl and Steve. Thanks for being the guest tonight.
Thank you very much, and it's been educational visiting with you, Bill.
Great.
Thank you.
Good night, folks. God bless you all. Good night, Annie. Good night, Pooh. Good night, Allison. I love you. I miss you with all my heart and soul. Maybe someday, if we can win this war, we can be back together. Luis, if you're listening, I've got a brand new trumpet here for you, and so get up here on this hill and pick it up. It's part of the grants that we give out every year to help people in the community. And if you learn to play that trumpet and don't miss any lessons over the next year, it's yours forever. We love you, boy.
Superman never made anybody, saving the world from Solomon Grundy. Sometimes I just tell the world we'll never see another man like him. Hey, Bob.
You've been listening to The Hour of the Time with yours truly, William Cooper, on Worldwide Shortwave Radio WBCQ Monticello, Maine, 7.415 megahertz, and 101.1 FM, Eager, Arizona. Don't miss tomorrow night's episode of The Hour of the Time.
Folks dead, his family were all dead, trying to crumble.
Once again, the number where you can pick up their book is 800-495-7059. That's 800-495-7059. 1995, worth every penny. Read about what these scum-sucking, cute-faced, lying, communist, socialist bastards are doing to this country. And then fight them! And don't stop until they're defeated.
Kept on changing clothes and dirty old phone booths till his work was done. And nothing to do but go home.
Superman's not dead, folks. Don't believe what they tell you in the comic books. He's alive. And he works all the time for truth, justice, and the American way.
Sometimes I despair the world will never see.